And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Ron N. from El Centro.
My name is Ron. I am an alcoholic. Who has the little duck whistle? Who has it? Do you have it? Thank you. Would you give it to one of these good-looking gentlemen? Because some of you may have heard on the news recently that gay people have certain signals, like in bathrooms and And when I heard that, I thought, I recognize that that's also one of our signals, so. Terry was asking if he could have it. Scared the hell out of him, didn't it? It's good to be here, and I feel right at home. Sometimes I think my program is not very well put together, and then, you know, duct tape. That's kind of how my program feels like. It's a little bit duct tape to the wire. But I'm, yes, I am Irish. Sometimes they wonder, you know, my God, can he really get up in front of people like that? I mean, shit, we used to be able to beat the fuck out of them. Now look at them walking around like they're human beings or something. Got a right to breathe. What the hell's he doing here anyway? He should be out decorating somebody's house. I believe, and happy birthday to the people with the birthdays. Congratulations. If I'd known that there were birthdays, I would have worn my pink bikini and jumped out of a cake for you. I've done that sometimes to see whether men are ready to go to any lengths to stay. And some of them aren't. It's I'll step over to the nearest fucking bar, you know, and try some controlled drinking. I ain't gonna. I'm really not gonna be too flamboyant this evening. I realize there are a number of newcomers here. Particularly, I assume there is at least one or two straight men out of the 15 of you who spoke, and I want to be respectful. I never want to hurt anyone's feelings. I just basically believe that straight. There's something wrong in your childhood if you're straight, and if you work your inventories and talk about it with your sponsor, you might overcome it in the sixth step. But don't worry, it's not necessarily going to happen. And I like to say to my straight friends, if you don't drink and you do work these powerful steps, that in 31 years you can turn out just like me. Now get on that step, baby. Shit. You'll be switching that earring by your fourth step. One of the things I've always appreciated, and the lady who spoke, and I think went home and asked for a replay of her husband's self-esteem analysis. But one of the things I've always appreciated is that people who have been sober for a long time are willing to get up in meetings and let their ass hang out and talk about how it isn't perfect in sobriety. And the shit does still hit the fan. I have a real problem going to meetings where people just stand up there and tell me how wonderful it is and how they have it all together after so many years, and if you would just do it the way they did it, you could be just like them. And usually I don't want to be like them. And that is not a solution. But I believe that this is a program of growth. And I don't mean that just as a cliche throwaway line. I believe that we must continue to grow and to grow and to grow and to change, or we will drink again. That it is mandated in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that we claim spiritual progress and not spiritual perfection. and those of us who sponsor, those of you who sponsor, we have an obligation to tell the truth to new people in this program. And if you're in pain, don't lie to them. They know it anyway. And if there's something really screwed up in your life and you're falling flat on your goddamn sober 20-year ass, get up in a meeting and talk about it. Because it isn't so much for you anyway. It's for the people out there who need some hope that they can stay sober and still be a screwed up mess and not drink and find joy and happiness and peace in their lives. And I'm thankful. I went to those early meetings at Pathfinders, closed men's and Pathfinders afternoon meetings when I got sober some years ago. And they were the toughest goddamn meetings in town. Biker got up one time and he rubbed his hands together and he looked at me and he said, "You newcomers, you don't know fucking anything. Go home and do your dirty dishes if you want to stay." "How do you know I had dirty dishes, you son of a bitch, you psychic?" He was a motorcycle rider, and later on I just wanted to go out and pat the leather. I was so moved by his. It was a meeting where one time two people in the afternoon got in a dispute over some girl. They were both trying to help her get sober and help her with any other spiritual needs that she might have. They wanted her to go to any lengths, I think, with them. And so they were getting into a dispute with each other over that, and one of them walked up to the podium and bit the other one's ear off. But they didn't drink over it. One of them died a year later in a motorcycle accident, but they didn't drink over it. So I hope that gives you all hope here where we can go. I'm told by the enforcement people that I speak until, 5 to 9 or 45 minutes, whichever comes first. Is that, I don't know whichever comes first, so we'll wrap it around 5 to 9. If I talk too long, I saw a couple cute sailors back there just come up and slap me around, and I'll keep right on speaking. The police, you know, right out here on this avenue, on wherever the hell it is, El Cajon Boulevard, when I was drinking in all these delightful bars around here, and they got used to me. They just thought I was neurotic because I could tell them about the sad story of my life and move them almost to tears. We alcoholics can do that. We are all actors, you know. And I could just tell them about how I was beaten by my Uncle John, and who made me play horsey at Christmas time, and all the horrible things that happened to me. And they'd get moved and wouldn't take me to jail and take me home. But sometimes they get disgusted with me, and they knew me by name, and they say, "Ron, you keep drinking like this, we're going to have to lock you up with hardened criminals." Well, get me a drink. I thought they were trying to be helpful. I know now it was enabling what they were offering. I want to talk a little bit tonight about what it was like when I came to this program in 1974, and I did not stay. And we sing that song, "Keep Coming Back Without a Drink." And sometimes I sing it, "Keep Coming Back With a Drink. Keep Coming Back, period. You know, leave the damn bottle outside." But we aren't saints here. And some of us didn't catch this really quickly. Some of us had to do a little more research and feel a little more pain, and then we came back. And maybe that time in 1974 is more important to my sobriety than when I did get sober in 1976. Because I came to this program, and I needed to be here. I was drinking into blackouts. I had already been put into nut houses. Well, I called them Centers for Emotional Redevelopment. They were fucking nut houses. And they were threatening to send me away. And I could not stop drinking. And then I found those little funny pills that you used to buy down in Tijuana, back in the day when Tijuana was more civilized. could walk into a bar, and they had little white crosses, which I thought was very spiritual. And you could get a roll of them. And all at once, the drinking that I was doing that would make me pass out, I just had this burst of excitement. I was rocketed into the 100th dimension. And I could talk and speak, and I spoke in several languages I didn't even know. To show you just how powerful they were and how low I got, I woke up one time in a female whorehouse. The shame of it all. Thank God. God was with me in those days because I was still dressed when I woke up. But I needed to be here. I was doing what we do. I would go to bars. I liked bars, like the lady who spoke. I loved to drink in those days. I loved the feeling. You took that drink and here we were. Look at us. Look at us as alcoholics. How many drank in bars? A lot. Yeah, I know. Some of you guys I've seen in those bars where I go. Yeah, they're going, oh, God, get me a girl next to me. He's going to say he saw me in that bar when it was. But I drank in bars, and weren't they wonderful places? They had little blue lights everywhere, and everyone looked good, didn't they? You know, after a few drinks. And everyone was charming, at least earlier in the evening. And they wore their evening and cow shit cologne, and we all looked wonderful and beautiful. But did you ever go to a funeral for one of those bastards who died that sat next to you thought was so pretty? And then all the people in the bar would come in. My God, they looked 900 years old. Those people you saw in daylight. So I preferred the bars with the soft lights that covered all of our sins. And I liked what drink did because, you know, our book defines us as alcoholics. Not alcoholics with booze in us, but alcoholics who are without our friend, booze. And we are selfish and self-centered, and we are subject to 1,000 forms of fear. And we either have no self-esteem, or we're so damn self-centered and arrogant that no one can bear to be around us. We don't believe in anything, and we want to believe in something. And we can't form relationships, and we can't barely communicate unless we're drinking. That is us as alcoholics. And you take a person like that, and many of us had screwed up childhoods. Let's just face it, we did. And I've been in therapy for a number of years, and look how well I'm doing now. I went one time when I was drinking, I went to a psychiatrist because everybody told me I had to. Well, I tried religion for a while. My father's a Baptist preacher. I'm working on him. He told me not long ago, you know, he's trying to be more liberal, because usually it's, you're sodomites, you're going to hell. I'm going to watch them when they put you there. And recently he's tried to be more liberal, and he said to me, he's 95, and he said, you know, I'm glad you're not drinking more, and you went to that anonymous alcoholic whatever cult. And, yeah, Dad, I do. He says, well, you know, I saw on the news this morning, I think Pat Robertson was talking about a group called Homosexuals Anonymous. I said, yeah. What's it about? Well, you can get free and cured of your homosexuality. You just go and take the steps there. And I said, well, I'd like to try that, Dad, but I just don't know what it means. You know, do you get down to one a day? Or, you know? And then I thought that would give new meaning to the phrase, I've reached my bottom. I don't think you can. He hasn't discussed that with me. Yes, tape all of this. Nobody likes me. I can sell it at the F Street Bookstore. But I came then into this program. And I'd been on a bender like we used to be on for several weeks. And I'd been in one of those relationships. And let's not talk too disparagingly about our relationships. Like alcohol, some of those sick fucking relationships kept us alive when we were suicidal and wanted to die. And we didn't care if we picked somebody up in a bar and gave him some drinks and $10 as long as he'd say, I love you. And whether he meant it or not didn't matter, because we were so damn needy. And would someone please just go home with me and not leave me alone? And we'd pay about any price for that. And I was in one of those sick relationships, and my paycheck ran out, and he fell out of love and went back to San Francisco. And so I went out on the streets again, and I picked people up again. And that was the thing mine, and I would pick strange people up, and I would take them home, and I would put myself in danger, and I have faced knives and faced guns, and I have faced terrible beatings, and we go back at it, it's its own form of insanity. And I was out doing that one night, and I came home and woke up, and there was all the paraphernalia on the floor. I didn't know I'd had a good time or not, but everything was gone in my apartment, and I was beaten up. And I called my aunt. And my aunt was the person I used to drink with up on University Avenue and Adams Avenue at the Elbow Club and the Ram's Head. That was back in the 70s. I loved the title of that bar, the Ram's Head. Somehow I fit there. So get those cowboys drunk enough and take them home. And she betrayed me. She, when I talked to her, who used to always drink with me, and my aunt was one of those who we were 60s hippies like, and she would always hug me and say, it isn't your fault. The reason you do these stupid, crazy things, the reason you get put in nut houses, and the reason you get arrested is because you had a rotten childhood. And society is cruel to you. And they hate you because you're gay. It's not your fault. It's their fault. And I was more than willing to consider her opinion, because it seemed right to me. And she betrayed me. She came and said, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. She had a moony look on her face, you know. She dropped some old acid or something. And like those, you know, 90-day wonders. Oh, I'm so happy in Alcoholics Anonymous. All my problems are solved. I don't think I'm ever going to hurt again. Shut up and get a sponsor and work the steps. You're sick and getting sicker. But she was in that place, and she said, no. So I called her. And I was all hungover and paranoid and speeded out. And I called her, and I said, I'm going to kill myself. I can't stand this anymore. She said, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, oh, no, another church. You know, they're going to save my whole soul or something again. And I'm not going. She said, no, no. I said, it'll be a bunch of straight people, and they're just going to judge me and blah, blah. She said, no. And this was back in 74. She said, no, they have gay meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Fucking sober queers. I don't know if I could handle that, you know. I had enough of my own goddamn problems. But I didn't have anything else to do. And she gave me this number. And some of you have been around a while and knew him. His name was Ross. And I may be a little swish, but I look like the goddamn Marlboro man next to Ross. And he called me. Or no, I called him, and he called me back. Hi, this is Ross. And I said, yes, well, I'm killing myself, and my boyfriends are beating me up, and I'm getting robbed, and I can't stop drinking and other things. And he said, you need to go to a meeting. I don't want to go to a meeting. I need to tell you my problems. I need someone to listen to me. Well, he didn't want to listen to me. He wanted me to go to a meeting. He kept saying, go to a meeting, go to a meeting. This fucker was stoned or something. So finally, so I could get him off my back to listen to me, I went to the meeting. Monday night. One of the first gay meetings in San Diego, 23rd and B Street. We went up a back stairway, of course. And not that kind of back. Anyway, we went in the rear. That doesn't. Well, anyway, we got up to the meeting, and I walked in. There were two big stomping bull dykes guarding the door. Short hair, you know, chains and shit. And then I walked in, and there were about nine queens sitting around in various stage of absolutely unacceptable dress. And one of them wearing an enormous turquoise fish. And then he had all kinds of bling bling from the early 99-cent stores. And he was rattling on from this big boy. Some of you may have known him. His name was Chuck H. He later went on to become one of the most respected members of Alcoholics Anonymous, was head of the business council for many years. I'll tell you one really quick side story before I lecture you on the steps. When I got sober a second time, Chuck was still around. He used to sit in meetings, and he'd take a big book, and he would caress and thumb it like it was some kind of erotic tool or something. He'd thumb that thing. And then he'd open it, and he'd read the part that says, "Lack of power is my dilemma." And then he'd look around, and we'd all be appropriately amazed, or he'd be pissed off. We'd heard it many times before. Well, when I was about 10 years sober, and Chuck died out in El Cajon. He was only in his 50s. And his job was to work on mobile homes out in El Cajon. And he was about 20 years sober, and he climbed up on a mobile home. It was one of those freak storms in El Cajon. And he got hit by lightning. And it killed him instantly. And they called me. I was on trip somewhere and asked me if I would come back and speak at the memorial. Very strange people. And they wanted me to speak at his memorial. And so I came back. His mother was in the front row. Now, his little mother used to come to meetings, open meetings with him all the time. She had nothing else to do, and she thought they were funny and she thought they were great entertainment. And she liked to hear her son get up and talk lies about his childhood. So she'd come to the meetings and sit right there and giggle and have a good time. Nobody cared. Well, she was in the front row. And it was a group, about 300 people. He was well known. And I hadn't quite prepared my remarks. And people were getting up and saying, "Oh, Chuck, you know, you will be at the great meeting in the sky, and yes, you led me down the 12-step road," and a bunch of other horrible cliches. And I got up, and I don't know what possessed me, but I said, "You know, Chuck used to read that part in the book called 'Lack of Power is My Dilemma,' and that certainly is not true now." Electrocution, you know. And I did. And nobody laughed. And they all went, like you're doing, "Oh, but you know who thought it was funnier than a crotch? His mother did. She thought that was a funny thing. She slapped her leg and thought that was real funny." Lack of power. Anyway, I went to that meeting, and I want to tell you, those who are new, that I heard a lot of things that you'll probably hear somewhere tonight, not necessarily from me. But you'll hear them in AA meetings. We will love you until you can love yourself. Don't drink no matter what. Come and take these steps. Get a sponsor. You know, do it for 30 days. And just go to meetings and don't drink. And all the wonderful things. And that we love you. And you'll find a higher power. And you'll be rocketed into a fifth dimension. And you'll never need Viagra. All kinds of wonderful promises are made. And I heard all that shit. But I didn't hear it. You can hear it and not hear it. And I heard it in my ears. But I did not hear it here. Because there was a very simple problem, and I offer it to you tonight for your own examination about whether or not you're ready to be here, is that I was not done drinking. I was done with a lot of things. I was done with the pain of hangovers. I was done with getting in trouble with the law. I was done with getting kicked out of family gatherings. I was done with getting fired. I was done with the awful physical, emotional, and spiritual shame that I felt. I was done with that. And I didn't want it anymore in my life. Of course I didn't. But I wasn't done drinking. And that is a different matter entirely. So I brought my pretty little queen ass in here and hoped that you guys would restore me. And what do they do now? Makeovers on TV. And I would emerge this new and bright and brilliant born-again person. And it didn't happen. And so, after 30 days, I wanted to drink again. Of course, I never would have admitted that, and we don't. But I really did want to drink again. And I'm a queen. So I couldn't just walk out of Alcoholics Anonymous and get drunk. I resigned from AA. In fact, I was even thinking of going down to central office and giving them a formal letter of resignation. And pointing out some of the defects of this program in case I ever came back. But I didn't. I went out and got drunken. I said I was going to stay sober, of course, on my own. Sure. And I was. But something terrible happened. I was up camping with my latest boyfriend, and he was supposed to gather wood for the fire, and he didn't, and that traumatized me, so I got a bottle of wine, and I got drunk. We have to have reasons to do this. And I was off on a drunken pursuit, this disease into the gates of insanity and death for a year and a half before I came back, and that was the best thing that I ever could have done. To get so done with drinking that nothing else matters to you but in your guts and your soul and wherever you live, when you have to face yourself alone, that you come to a place that says, I don't give a goddamn what happens to me. I don't want to ever drink again. And I had to get to that place. I don't talk too much about my childhood anymore. I think it is relevant. I've done my inventories, but a few things about it is that I was born in a manger in a small town in Michigan. And my father, before he was a preacher, was about a 20-year drunk. And I mean, he was a real drunk. He would walk through the snowdrifts and nearly freeze his ass off to get to the bar. In the year that I was born, and never mind, but the year that I was born, my father was having an affair. I was the sixth child, and he was screwing some 16-year-old girl and got her pregnant and was trying to borrow money to have her paid off or get her an abortion. He had some problems in his life. And my mother threw me in an orange crate and the other five kids and took off on a bus down to her mother. So my dad was facing being alone and kicked out of the house and no money to drink. And so he got religion. And I want to say about that people say, well, I respect. Actually, my father got religion and didn't drink, but he never did the things that we had to do, like an honest inventory and make amends and find a way to change our lives. He never did. And he came then to a sober life without alcohol, as an alcoholic, with all of that terrible anger and all of that terrible self-centeredness and violence. And since now he was a religious person, he didn't need to deal with any of those things. And that's what I grew up with, because I never saw my dad drunk, but I certainly saw him in rage, and I knew what it meant to be an abused kid. And I won't tug on your heartstrings too much, but there were two befores when I was 12 years old, and feet, and stomped. And when he went into his rages, he went in like we did when we drank, and he could not stop until he'd worked it out. And I was his most frequent victim. That's, my brother said it's because I was such a bitch. And that may be whatever it was, but I grew up in that crazy place in Michigan. And what I wanted most of all, my friends, was to get the hell away. And it started a pattern of me, if I can just get away, if I can just move somewhere else, if I can just physically get out of this mess, I'll be okay. I'll be okay. I know, well, it's just where I am. That's the problem. We call them geographics now, what alcoholics do, and I started it early. And I didn't drink much, except one time in high school I was on a hayride, and there was a girl named Elizabeth Nickert. And she was over-endowed in too many places. And like a lot of women like that, she had a thing for gay men. I think it was a matter of female pride with her that she's going to switch me somehow. And we were on a hayride, and she was kept trying to get at me, and she had these very long, long lips before whatever that woman is now with those big, fake, puffed-up lips. And she would chase me around that, and finally, somebody gave me a couple beers, and I dove down into the hay and escaped. So right away, I knew that beer could help me escape, you know, traumatic situations. But I didn't drink much until I joined the Navy. When I graduated, I left my parents' house, never went back, only to visit. And I didn't know what else to do, and I joined the Navy. And I think I set out, like many of us did, on a mission to be such a good person and do such wonderful things that someday my dad would say, I'm proud of you, and hug me and tell me he loved me. He has not done so yet. It just doesn't matter so much anymore. But I joined the Navy. I was defending your country, marching around with my little gun and twitching my little tail with those little ribbons. And actually, I was a pretty good sailor. I was very well received at Miss Congeniality and boot camp. And they all wanted to march behind me. But I went into a bar one night when I went to some Navy school in Florida. And I went into a bar, and I'll never forget it. It was a spiritual moment. It was an epiphany. I saw the light. I ordered, because I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know what it was, and I ordered a shot of Chivas Regal Scotch. And I downed it, because somebody told me, and my life changed. It was a life-changing moment. It was blue lights. It was orgasm. It was rising to the pinnacle of emotions where you never have to leave. And we say alcohol is not powerful. Oh, yes, it is. It changed everything. Every one of you sitting in the bar, I would have looked around sober and said, they all hate my guts, want to beat me up or rob me, or they just hate me in general. And now, once you guys were transformed, you were my friends. I go right up to you and blatity, blatity, blat. And I go up to the toughest redneck and hand him my telephone number and said, think I can help you with your problems? I was so goddamn brave. But most of all, remember how good it felt inside not to be for just a little while so afraid. To not to be so terribly angry. To not to feel so terribly worthless and disgusting and loathsome and shameful. All at once I was, as Jesse would say, somebody. And that is a very powerful thing. And if that had continued to work for me, I would not stand here tonight in Allied Gardens talking to you about my life. I would still be using it. Because I think in many ways alcohol saved my life. When I could turn nowhere else, when no one else understood, alcohol would take me away for just a little while. And so I drank through my 4 years in the Navy, and I got out, and Dad still didn't love me, and I still was a mess, only now I had alcohol. And I went through 4 years of school and got a degree from San Diego State University, and I graduated with honors, and my drinking was so pathological that I don't remember many of the professors I had. We can do that. We really can do things like that. You can sit in a class drunk on your ass and write a brilliant paper. You can. And I would manage. And then as soon as I got my degree, I did what any alcoholic would do. With a degree from a prestigious university, I had a job working in a liquor store. It made sense to me. Those customers needed to hear about Shakespeare when they were buying their white port wine. And so for a series of years, I worked in stores, and then every once in a while, I'd get, remember how we got reform things? And I'd reform. I'm going to change my life. And I'd fly off to Kentucky and join some program and last about 2 weeks, which I did, and get drunk again and tell them they were all sick sons of bitches and go out and get drunk. And that's what I did for a number of years until 1974. And I went to that meeting that I told you about, and by then I'd been to the psychiatrist, and I had the arrest, and I had the lockup in the crazy houses. And I'm going to mention something about being locked up in crazy houses. There used to be one called 8 East. It was up in what is now the Hillcrest area, where those damn homos have taken over and ruined everything. But there was a place up there, and it was called 8 East. It was co-ed. And they threw me in there one time because I'd been to Tijuana and I was rife on speed and I'd been drinking for 2 days and I was out of my mind, truly, truly, psychotically out of my mind. I was running down university, I think tearing my clothes off and singing Amazing Grace. It just seemed logical to me. And they picked me up and they put me in a nut house. And they strapped me down. And I woke up strapped down. And I thought at that moment, I will never realize my dream. I'd always wanted to be a school teacher. I used to play school teacher when I was a kid, you know, and I was in such control, and I'd make my neighbor friends and all sit down, and I'd lecture them like I'm doing tonight, and that's blah, blah, blah. But I, you know, ever since, I think when I was a little girl of six, I knew that I wanted to be a teacher. And so here I was, and I woke up on that stretcher, and I thought, I'll never teach. My dreams are gone, and I want to say to my friends, and I don't give a shit how far down you go. I don't care what horrible things you've done. There is always hope. There is always hope for change and dreams in sobriety. There is. And I just, this year in June, retired from teaching 20 years in the Imperial Valley, and I retired with a great deal of respect and many anxious parents because I was the moral role model for their children. And I realized my dream. And that I owe totally, without any reservation, without any hyperbole, I owe to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would never have been able to do that had I not gotten sober. But one night, I've never in the years I've talked not mentioned this, so in my 10 minutes left. Where's the buzzer? How are we doing? Excuse you. We are tolerant, but... you know, but one night I had been in and in out of drunks, and I went to... I had gotten some kind of a move up to San Francisco, and I was working in another bar, or a liquor store. And I had a boyfriend, and I always had boyfriends, and they were always sick sons of bitches, and they were hustlers, and they were evil, and they were emotionally unavailable, and they were abusive, and they were just the type I needed. I just, whenever I would see one of them, I would start packing my trousseau and looking for a wedding dress, because I knew they were for me. And this little Arkansas escaped convict son of a bitch grabbed my heart, and off I went to San Francisco, and one night I went to a party with him. And I was very, very jealous, really, really, and still am, still working on it. But I was very jealous, and I walked into a room, and I saw him with someone, I don't know to this day what it was. Maybe that's a blessing. I mean, he might have been with a crocodile, or he might have been with early Angelina, I don't know. But he was with someone, and I couldn't handle it, and I went out to the kitchen, and I got a tumbler full of gin, and I got a handful of Preludin, which was a downer in those days, and I downed them both. And my alcohol betrayed me. And instead of getting drunk, I just got numb. That's a terrible, that is pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, because this was my last friend and it betrayed me. And I got on a plane, I gave up my job, I gave up my apartment, and I flew home to Michigan. And I talked to my dad about God. And I was desperate. And I weighed 125 pounds. And you'd think, that queen's done. We don't know. You ever seen people in AA meetings, the arrogant bastards, and somebody will walk in and say, oh, well, I think he'll make it, but I don't think she'll make it. Well, thank you, God. I didn't know you were attending our meeting. We'll elect you secretary. The people would have looked at me and said, he'll make, he's ready, you know. He's got to get to AA. He's done. But I wasn't. Because we're not done until we're done. And I flew back to San Diego and got another job in a liquor store and got another boyfriend. And there I was. And now this one night in 1974, I was going to go out. And remember how? Just one drink. And then I'm going to go home and take a shower, perhaps an aromatic therapy shower, and watch some Shakespeare on PBS. Didn't get there. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. And I was walking down the street in a blackout drunk, and I came out of it long enough to see two men there, and one of them had a weapon. And I invited them home because we pursue this into the gates of insanity and death. And I didn't want to go home alone. And I invited them home, and I sat on the floor of my apartment, and I knew I was going to be damaged, and I knew I could do nothing about it, as if I were in a bubble. And I woke up the next morning, and my face was badly battered. And everything in the apartment was gone once again. And I called little Auntie, hoping she'd come over. It's not your fault, dear. Society. She came over, and she walked in, and she said something that I hope every alcoholic gets to hear sometime in their lives. She said to me, if you want to continue to drink, Go ahead. But I'm not going to watch you kill yourself. I'm out of here. There's a meeting at Pathfinders at 1 o'clock. I suggest if you're serious, you go. And I went. And I was done. I was done drinking. I wasn't done with the anger. I wasn't done with the fear. People say sometimes it isn't enough. Just do not drink. Ignore them. They're probably plants from Al-Anon. It is enough sometimes to just not drink, because for a long time that's all I had. I couldn't buy all this stuff about the steps and the spirit and how we would all reach some kind of a place where we would float above our alcoholism and rise up and sit by Bill W. at the hand. I didn't get there. I was angry and I was afraid and I was bitter and I hated every son of a bitch in this program. But I had no place else to go. And it glued my ass to these steps because I was done drinking. And you know, when we say that we can't just not drink, I say you can. Because if you're an alcoholic and you just don't drink, this is a self-corrective program. And eventually your pain, your fear, your loneliness, your sense of degradation will be so overwhelming that you will pick up those steps and take them, or you'll drink again. It's no mystery. We stood at the turning point. This was it. And eventually I took the steps. And now, as you can see, after 31 years, what a wonderful, wonderful bit of progress I have shown. In my last couple of minutes here, I want to tell you from my heart about how much I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not fooling when I tell you it not only saved my physical life, but anything I have today that is spiritual and emotional that works, I got it here. And this year, I retired and I was poised to do all the things I wanted to do. And for some reason, I thought I had it all together, and I fell in love with a young man a few years, quite a few years younger than I am. And after he'd taken my paycheck and taken my heart and been in an abusive relationship, I broke up with him. And I want you to know that we do have pain in Alcoholics Anonymous sober. And people 30 years of sobriety have pain. And if you think that they don't, or you think you won't, you're in for the surprise of your life, because here I was speaking in meetings around the country, and that I was this revered elder stateswoman of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what was I doing? But I was sitting on the beach in San Felipe and crying like someone had beaten me. And all at once I had this thought that I had not had in many years. I thought, I don't want to drink, but I just wish I could find something that I could take that would get me over this pain for a little while, because it's intolerable. I cannot stand it. And that scared the hell right out of me. And I got up and walked over and knocked on the door of a fellow member of Alcoholics Anonymous and put myself in her care and told her what was going on, because I need this program. And now I'm going to meetings and talking about it. And talking about the depression that came, and talking about the outside help I got, and talking about, in the context of love for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I belong here, that I am free, that there's no amount of pain that God and I can't handle, and that finally I always come down to this question, and I give them to people I sponsor. I say, here is your decision. Whatever the pain is, whatever the emotional upheaval, no matter how depressed you, ask yourself honestly this question: would a drink make it better? And a drink would not have brought him back, and I knew it. And so, I was back in meetings, and back in writing, and back in sharing with friends. And I'm stronger today than I've ever been in my sobriety. Changing, moving, painfully sometimes, but God, how good it feels when you see there's something new in your life. Because we cannot stay here if we cannot change. So I'm in a good place tonight. 31 years ago, I walked into these rooms and I wanted to die. And tonight, I want with everything that I have in my soul to live, to enjoy this adventure, to go up, to go down, to go in, to go out, to go in pain, to go in joy. I want to know it all. I want to feel it all, and I owe it all to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, finally to my new friends in this program, if none of this made any fucking sense to you, and it probably shouldn't. And if none of it gave you any great sense of hope, maybe it shouldn't. But what I will offer you this, if you don't drink, you will not get drunk, no matter what anybody says, no matter what they predict. If you don't drink, you will not get drunk. That's always true. So come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and don't drink, and join us in the fellowship of the Spirit. It's a good place to be in AA. It's good to be here. Thank you.